paint and some political will, and they're taking back the streets of New York that were laid out by Robert Moses in an automobile brought, you know, taking advantage of all that public space. And actually now with Bloomberg as the mayor, it's just phenomenal what's going on in New York City. I just wanted to mention that. And that's part of that education, because what she's saying, what's working is they're going out and, you know, did you know that X, you know, that this meant, just simple things that most people don't know, but she has such a clear way of communicating, and her staff and that whole work, that whole, just looking at how that government is functioning might really educate a lot of us on how, why, you know, that's working. But I wanted to mention that. Well, they basically maybe Liz can explain it better than I, but I mean, they're basically going into the New York, taking a lot of Broadway, and many streets in New York are now being taken back for pedestrian, and bikeways are being, they're taking automobile space for the first time ever away and giving it to people. In fact, they are so popular that when they show up with the barrels and block off a street, the people, you know, there's pent-up demand for public space in New York City. People are, like, out on the streets ready to with their chairs. They move into these spaces and basically set up camps. This is home to them. And it's just a fascinating social experiment. It's more than an experiment. I mean, they're basically, she thinks she's drawing and believes, and I think she is drawing the lines for the future of New York with paint.
New York is very famous in prejudice and Los Angeles. It's not going to be so popular.
No, it took a lot of New York to make it happen there, too. There's a lot of people that like their cars in New York, so. But
well,
anyway, you're right, but there's some gestation of this, but it's not, I think what we often eliminate things that are possible that may not be, you know, and so you don't, but anyways, I talked a couple things on the business cases, and Wendy, this is from our conversation before, but there is a business case to be made to the banks that they should care about the cost of location when they lend money because of their own security for finance, that in fact, there's a case that vulnerability exists by not including transportation costs in the location associated with outlying areas having bigger transportation costs. So there's a lot of work that's been done on this in the U.S., but no one has stepped up to the plate. Van City in Vancouver is interested, and maybe there's a couple others. We can get one bank to do this and work together and make it a joint effort. I think we could have they could become the green lender.
Well, maybe we should track them down, because I think the case comp might be here.
What?
I think the case comp is probably here somewhere at the conference.
Okay. So
we call the bank.
Right.
There are banks, you know.
Right, no.
Banks,
Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation is possibly, you know, I don't know how to approach them on that, but anyway, the other one is distance-based vehicle insurance. These two may go together, but right now you pay for your car insurance, you drive as much as you want. Typically, it doesn't change much. You get a little bit of a tweak if you don't, say, you drive to work or whatever, you know. But the bottom line is, if you didn't drive, you shouldn't have to pay insurance because you can't. You're not, except the cost of your comprehensive, if something landed on your car and you blew up or whatever. But that, other than that, so basically, you don't cause a risk. So then it transfers the insurance from a sunk to an incremental or marginal cost at the event of the decision when you decide to walk or take transit or bike or drive, and therefore you have that rationale, if I don't use the car, I won't have any insurance to pay this month. It could make it a significant difference, and automobile insurance companies are against this for a reason, because they know that there's an incentive for people then to drive less, and their revenues would go down. So the business issue on that is even ICBC, so we have a public insurance utility in British Columbia, and they're a Crown corporation, so they're kind of a super type, but they like making money too, even though they're not pure private for profit. They sure act like they are. So anyways, that's another one. So those two, and no one's, we haven't talked about, only just reference congestion pricing in London. But congestion pricing is sort of out there. It almost got passed in New York. It was only at the state level that it got killed. So that's something that, you know, if public health moves forward on congestion pricing, the revenues from congestion pricing could be what's used to underwrite affordable housing at transit stations. It can be used to underwrite new urbanist communities and smart growth and all these things we've been talking about, and I don't know how that could proceed.
Well, I'm just
going to
take those three ideas and just maybe subject them. We have a little bit of time.
I just wanted to say, I don't know there are any
good. Well, no, okay, sounds good, but let's just test them. Let's give them the consumer test. I have to sound like business opportunities, but would they pass the consumer test? You know, would people be willing to be able to borrow less money on their home if they wanted to live in the suburbs and borrow more money if they're prepared to live in the city? And I guess that would be the consumer option of the first proposal. Does that sound to people viable? People say they move to the suburbs because they have no choice. You probably know more about these behaviors maybe than other people do. I've always loved the suburbs, so it's not a good example. But
so the municipal taxes are a major reason why people move away.
The what?
The municipal taxes.
People pay less taxes when they go to small communities.
So how far are we willing to
offset
this contradiction by setting suburban municipalities against?
Because if the definition is the differential in incremental household transportation costs defined the difference.
But I'm just saying what you're proposing sets suburban municipalities on a conflict course with this.
Yeah, that's true. Some would say, too bad.
No, it's a very good idea, and I'm just
an idea. It's been out there a while.
Teasing out the tensions and issues which will emerge out of this. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, those three, let's just not lose them. So there's the house, the just mortgage. You've got a term for it, which we'll catch later if you've got a whole name for it. Then you put the distance and transport.
Insurance, mortgage lending, automobile insurance, and home lending, and congestion, revenues from congestion pricing to underwrite housing, affordable housing.
Larry, did you say that someone has done distance-based insurance?
There have been a couple of companies that have tried. They're now starting to tiptoe towards it. One was company in Texas, actually. It was small. I can't remember, but Oregon has there is an insurance company in Oregon that is looking at it, Liberty.
And you touched on this accidents and fatality among young drivers. This is a very closely tied issue from what you're saying, Larry, because now there is some evidence-based argument from a very different angle.
Well, we tried this in British Columbia, and that was the issue with it, was that there are certain people that are more at riskier drivers. So they couldn't be in the program. They're in the old program. They pay, you know, a flat fee. But for the folks that are 25 to 65, and then you get into risky behavior at elderly age, more than 65 to 70.
Yes. What's coming very clear is we have two layers of this debate. We have a domestic North American versus Canada, which is basically a level of this debate. We have a deep one, which is the panic going on in the rest of the world because of the overdose of the United Kingdom. For this conference to work on the global scale rather than the domestic North American scale, which I think is the purpose of the region, information we were selling, so that's why we came. It has to get above your domestic household. Very important. Otherwise, why not just have domestic one? The world wants leadership. And if a rich country like Canada, a strong country like the United States, has anything to offer the world, it mustn't be part of its own farmer, but for the sake of farmer. You're questioning the validity of the car, and we talk about fuel transportation systems. We're questioning whether the extra 3 to 4 billion people that to come on this earth in the next few years, that's 2 decades, is going to be able to live on it. Well, you can't live on it with American and Canadian standards. They've gone. As the United States declines, still has its major weapons, of course, as has declines in the world, as they're steep. What can it offer? It has a chance to offer something. Declining empires tended to end in a blip. British Empire, and the Second World War, so how off? What can this part of the world, so driven as it is, taking up an over supply of the world's resources, give back to the world? Because we have all the brains here. We have wonderful means of production information. Communication is fantastic. A conference like this, I don't think we really have it in the United States. That would not be the end of the empire. tolerance can produce paperwork in the next 3 days that could rock the world of political and professional leadership. Now, you stay with changing your insurances and risk your money, right? Or introducing something that's old hat and couldn't in New York. Or you can go vote. I think it would be nice to have your own two levels. Let's have the expertise across the world, it's super. But that's no good just doing it here. Do it for the world, because they want that help.
Canada need to extend its hand and help with its.
I guess it's some of this, though, I would say, is part of a controlling and limiting the excessive consumption that, you know, perhaps, you know, part of the golden balance. But I think the challenge can be different. But maybe you have thoughts yourself. You've got to practice yourself. That shows.
I do it, but as you can see, it's back in my head against the wall sometimes. We have to reduce our consumption. Otherwise, you're going to have a world war. And the target will be both America as well as Europe. And if you don't see that as professionals, that you're all intelligent, I think I am. I'm even living in these communities. They are seething. Right? It takes me 2 years to get into these communities. They hate me. Right? What you do here, you go back to your little class and eventually you have to win them over. And when you win them over, you've got to empower them. They are an army of endeavour. And it's on the right side of the law. We have to change the law to make it work. But a lot of change bits of the law. When you have this army of people, the power it gives you, you exude with your own professional power. Just imagine that power is against what you can keep. You can't keep at the moment 2 billion people in the world outside the game that we're trying to keep. Because the other 4 billion can't sustain it. That panic that the people in. We must offer these people a service as professionals. And you've got to do it in the European and North American. And the rest of the world is catching up fast economically. But it's also copying and aping some of our systems and keeping some of the little classes going. Who will need them? We heard today about slums. Darabee, where I've lived in Darabee, which is on that. Can actually work. There are plans to get rid of that major right in the centre of the island. But it has pipe water, they bought it illegally. It has electrics. When I gave a lecture there, I didn't see any sockets. I had the old fashioned carousel. And the chairman kept saying, don't worry, when it's time, when it gets dark, we'll have electrics. And I'm wondering where. And you know what he did? He took the leads, you know, the car battery charges, one on the line outside the window, and one on the user. Power on what we they survive. It's illegal, don't pay for it. They survive. If we don't give it up, we don't help them, they'll take it.
It's a challenge.
He said the common deficit.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people that want to come in and
there's actually a question, because I think what you're saying is that there's a two-pronged effort needed. One is that the privileged need to reduce consumption so that you're addressing it from one end, and then we've heard that participation, I don't mean to oversimplify, but I will, that participation and work from the other side needs to be occurring, and there are people here who are doing that. But I think you were also saying that the consumers, besides reducing consumers, need to make some other kind of bridging or outreach effort, and it might be useful to speculate on what that would be. Because I suppose the World Bank is not that.
No.
It's not just throwing money at the.
Don't throw money at it. Throw encouragement, empowerment, teaching. You'll bring these people out. Because they have the power.
So how do we do that?
That's the question. That's what we're here for. That's what I'm here for. I think that's what Tina's here for. I think that is here for. That's not the difficult kind of domestic.
So how do we enable what you're doing to be more more common, that there's more resources to do the kind of thing you're doing?
Because in this room, we have some of the world leaders think broadly, beyond the box, not inside the box of our presentations. There isn't much time left. These politicians, religious leaders, professional institutions, you know, have not got the respect for the reasons they deserve. They're full of the right people, but somehow the world's poor has lost faith in them. It's a fact of life. I expect a conference like this to tackle that dilemma. Instead of talking about minor improvement within the domestic situation of North America, which has to change anyway, for this area of the world to survive, it has to reduce its intake of the East of the world. There are only so many of them. We have two great big globes showing from North America on this screen today. Well, that's all we've got. There's nowhere else to go. We're going to double the number of people by 2060. Are you ready for that? That's what this conference is about. The one in Tokyo from the UIA in 2011, the United, is called 2050. It's already thinking about this. What happens when the West European, the Japanese, and the North American reduce their consumption by 200-300%, which you need to do to share the goodies with the growing market or the world's poor? We should have the brains to attack on that rather than think that we're just saving on insurance for a car. We're not just brushing up the floor with some fluff. We're changing the shape of the house.
I
think it's fair to say that the incentive structure at some scale is going to probably be part of the answer.
From an economist perspective, it's way too simplistic, but people react to costs and what they're facing. I mean, I was born and raised in Montreal and now living in Ottawa, and one of the big changes for me in that shift, amongst many of them, was water. In Montreal, we don't pay for water. In Ottawa, it's metered. And that's a big change to how you handle and use water. If we could adjust our pricing so that it's not just an economic cost, but it's a true cost. It's a cost that includes societal impacts, it's a cost that includes environmental impacts, and it doesn't take a one-year look. It takes how much of this do we have and when is it going to peter out? If we did that with oil, we saw last year when it hit $1.40, I think I'm going to take a bus. I think I'm going to carpool. I think I'm going to do something else because it's starting to hit. People react to cost, and you can educate them, you can tell them things, but when it hits the bottom line, and I think that's what you were getting at in your suggestion.
Yeah, both suggestions, that was it. Yeah, it's not.
We should put the meters on many other things in our life.
and adjust the price according to how long you think that's going to last.
There's a whole thing, about taxing consumption rather than income.
I'm a little concerned that our mandate is to come up with three strategic business opportunities rather than a more broader
survival
and philosophical concerns. So I
think
quite focused on thinking along those lines.
I think the underlying rationale for belief is that maybe it means spelling out, it's just that there isn't any one single silver bullet to solve these huge problems, and that moral will and political influence will have a place, but maybe a place that's been still left vacant, not pick the ball up, is the whole sort of business and economic dimension of a world that is very importantly driven by markets. So that's why the business opportunity is not meant to be little being the incentive structure, just another player. So thank you. Hoping you spoke with the successful businessman.
No, I'm going to really offend Peter's thing, just saying that during my lifetime, the population of the world has doubled. In the next 40 years, it's set to increase by as much. It's impossible to sit through the discussion today and not think, is that going to make those health inequalities, the social inequalities, any easier? I mean, it doesn't fall into quite that business thing, but it's sort of
it's just going to get worse.
It's sort of a question that has, you know, if we were an intelligent species, it would be a question I'm sure we would ask.
Not to be confused with the facts, but there is actually the demographics are shifting, you know, and the repopulation rates are very down with economic growth in the major, most populated areas. The demographics are reducing to less than 2 children, you know, physically and non sustainable rate. So the good news is that though it's already a big problem, it isn't necessarily the population projections that I see in any way suggest that it's not going to be as bad as one might have originally thought. Anyway, that's just a feature of it. I think that Lewis, you want to say something in Danny? And I think I'm already not doing
yes.
a good job
so
as Abby did.
Yeah.
Oh dear. So I think after that, unless there's any burning comments, I think we better look at our list and see what we can, you know, what we think the shape of it might be for. So, Jan.
Something that I've come to understand and to apply is from universities the allocation of resources. All of us on a daily basis have to deal with that, whether it's your income, you get £10 a day, for example, how do you spend that £10 to benefit yourself? So we're always looking at not spending more than our income, but then some people don't have an income. How is it that we create an income for those poor people out there living in slums, in areas with no health benefits, that can, in a way, that can have the resources that we have access to? For example, there was an article I read, I'm not too sure what my source is, but it looked at how the American middle class was spending the same amount of resources that 1.2 billion people in India were consuming. And in those figures, I'm not too sure what the income, what the population size of the middle class of America is, sorry, but just looking at India itself, and if that country is going to expand in the way that I think it's going to, forget the one-child policy in China. These people are having more children than you can probably imagine. And if they, in our world today, were to consume what we, you and I, consume, we've got nothing left. 5 years and then we're done. So what are you going to say in this time which is really going to affect this and create opportunities for people in poor societies, in slums? How do we do it? So first, if you look at one's example of self-help, self-build, you educate these people. They don't have access to education. You educate them. After they have and gained some experience and skill, they can sell that skill. That becomes a commodity. For that skill, there comes an income. That income then helps them consume either medical expenses, paying for their children to go to school themselves. So it's almost like a rebuilding of society, but from the grassroots up. And, you know, the other thing that I keep on picking up on is that are we trying to control our society? Are we controlling, we've controlled pretty much everything anyway, but, you know, metering our water, to metering the amount of electricity that we use, to setting the standard of life within one climate that differs in, say, a slum in Brazil.
I'm confused. Well, I mean, there's a, you know, there's a lot in there, but I think what I would take from that might, you know, might, I think, strengthen the kind of, you know, arguments that you're making is the, you know, is the idea that maybe cities should see their own residents as more as a resource that they can be trained and whether it be food production, house building, you know, a whole range of things, of amenities and community life. And they're often not thought of as a resource, they're thought of as a deficit. So, you know, changing that way of thinking would probably present lots of business opportunities, and we've seen quite a few too. I'm going to sort of just make a deadline so that, one, I don't want to embarrass myself completely at having failed to meet your deadline. So we're 5 minutes over now. I'm going to do about 5 minutes with whatever questions are now registered, which I think Daniel's next. Are you slipping in under the line? And was there another one?
I was.
Oh, sorry, Vikram. Daniel, Vikram. I think then we're going to draw it to a close, and we're going to ask Peter to do his heroic best. But I think some of these ideas of, you know, seeing the people within the cities in this sort of multi-sectoral way of working across governance may, you know, maybe comment across the city.
I was just thinking, of course, I'm worried about the most philosophical problems that they're bringing, but I'm also worried about our task. We're just taking notes on business rules that can bring us to a better world, or whatever we're trying to advise here. But we saw here a few examples of what business can do. We have companies, development companies, building affordable housing with intelligent design, design that will promote sustainability and active life. We can have the private sector supporting urban agriculture. We can have the private sector influencing, it's a very crucial role, having its power to influence the government to behave better, to do their homework and social policies, education and health, and to build government capacity. The managerial skills they have to improve social policies. I think the private sector can improve, government can improve, can give voice to the poor with their power, increasing participation. I was thinking about the other side of costs, having people pay more for things that are bad for the environment, bad for health. The other side of this is incentives. Incentives, we have, for example, we have in several countries, we have health insurance companies giving incentives for people for good behavior, for being active, for eating better, for, you know, they're paying for these people because it reduces their cost. So we can think on private and public policies that help people change behavior into a more sustainable behavior, more healthy behavior. So there's a lot of ideas here that came up today that can be included in this.
And I think that's right. Thinking, you know, the getting through the list and just shaping them into the sort of best potential strategic opportunities, I think, is what we're going to put, and we're going to
give a bit more than that. If we try to look at what Daniel says as a kind of generic theme, as he says, there is a disconnect. What Gerard says, there is a disconnect at a great level. What Ian says, there is a disconnect. What Elizabeth says, even children, there are disconnects. It is willingness to challenge ourselves as professionals or as practitioners, people without titles, or people without what. It is this disconnect which really representative of the symptom. The cause is the inclusion, which Daniel says. Can they be included in the business plan? This is a very difficult challenge to set ourselves. How do we make them included in the business plan? And not just to make profit at the bottom of the pyramid, but to make them empowered through not just inclusion, but making them part of the business cycle, as the United States. Then the approach becomes a slightly different one in terms of building up a business model which tries to focus on both, whereas we are focused on one. Number two, which includes as a partner and as an investor of different kinds in this game. And number three, through the process, making them beneficiaries so that the groups which we are talking about are empowered through proper connectivity into the society. I think that is the meta challenge we somehow have to frame our challenges into.
Yeah, because I don't think any, you know, we know that doing things for people has not really had any benefits, so it's got to be that connected kind of empowering process.
Just wanted to add a few comments on the fact that actually I think there is a strong potential for convergence between government or municipal intervention and economic opportunity and business opportunity. I will illustrate my point very quickly with an example of a city in France where I used to live, where the mayor one day decided to close the city center to the cars and make it a walkable environment. And business community was really not happy with that decision. And for 2 years, the city was a mess because they were reshaping the streets and removing all the paveways and putting a tramway, and it was really a mess. But afterwards, city center became very fashionable area to be in, and businesses were flourishing. And then you had other parts of the city which hadn't been transformed, where business communities were asking the mayor, please change our part too. And so I think there is a very often convergence, and we see today with a sustainable sustainability, which becomes also a brand for business opportunity. And to finish my example, here in Montreal we have Bombardier, which is a leading company worldwide, selling tramways and trains all over the world. And we don't have tramways in Montreal. It seems that there is a business opportunity here that is, you know, with locally produced tramways, which could be very interesting. So I think that's a comment. Sorry? No, it's Fatima.
Okay, well, this is not a final go at these conversations, so let's not sort of set the bar too high for ourselves. But well, I'm sure, you know, we can go through some here. I'm not going to ask. I think we can sort of stand on the ground. I think it was common, and not try and repeat it, about the, you know, the three circles and the importance of the integration of those sectors. You know, the importance of the multi-tier government, the cross sectors involvement. You know, I'm going to stand on that ground as captured. And then maybe move on from there to think more about some of the practical as well as perhaps some more ambitious kind of strategies, hopefully business strategies, but I know we haven't really kept on to that, that we could sort of shape for the next discussion. Do you have any kind of, do you feel able to sort of group them at all at this point either?
One of the big dilemmas I think that we face is our original charge, I think, was how do you make the cities of the north more livable and more healthy? And the Michael Marmot model really focuses on inequities within developed countries where we're not dealing with many of these problems that exist in the developing world, which overwhelm some of these other considerations. We, however, have devoted quite a lot of time to talking about the gross inequities in the world between the north and the south, and I do think that they're sort of two separate agendas.
I think I certainly think the pitch for the conference will be the two, and I think we'll put the WHO report just to sort of make sure we're all on the sort of right. It's difficult because I think one is about suppressing consumption, the other is about how to, you know, find solutions to kind of. But, you know, I think, you know, I hear that, you know, we've had a new group.
Just sorry. Real quick, in the U.S., and this is, I'm going to speak to another example that may not help with the agenda that I think needs to happen globally, but I think it's important to mention, is that investors are underwriting smart growth using real estate. There's the smart growth real estate investment trusts that are being created. I don't know in Canada and elsewhere around the world, but a lot of these things are transferable globally.
Yeah.
They're not just North America. There's other countries that do mortgage lending that could, you know, deal with these things. So it's not like this is just only geographically constrained in any way. But the other one is where business opportunity. If we know that places that have characteristics that are more health promoting and more walkable are under a lot of demand, we could invest in those places and that's what's being done. So that could be a real estate investment trust or something. Liz, Heather.
Well, the helicoptering up again, and thinking that this is an issue that we're not the first to confront, and there's some very big thinking and acting that's already been going on. We might look at what those things are and say, and try to hang our hat on it to say what could, how does that affect then our topic, sustainable community. So one of them is the International Energy Accords, which, and pollution accords, which are about saying we're going to start putting a cost to, I'm not sure I agree with the way it's being done, but it's out there and everybody's onto it in one way or another, which is saying that we're going to enable people to use energy and other people will pay for it, for the emissions and so on. And similarly are the global trade agreements, which then encourage what may not be sustainable in the long run but might get help economic development currently, which is sending food around the globe. How do those big things affect your land on the ground in those communities? I'm not sure, but it might be worth saying if that's a kind of big movement that's already happening, we can't invent something else. How do those things help what you all are doing already? And maybe one of those things, and then there's a third thing, I think, that the Gates Foundation, Soros, the big people who are saying we're going to cure AIDS, or Paul Farmer, tuberculosis, and to say there needs to be a community strategy, some sort of geographic community building strategy that's attached to that, because somebody, you pointed out, you might give them the medicine, but they're going back to the place where they got sick in the first place. And so it may be about enlightening those efforts in some additional way by saying, and if you want to succeed, you need another component. I don't know how we give them that component, but
I'm going to ask Peter to sort of do his best to sort of pilot the areas we have just so that we can get it.
Could I just say, we were invited here to the Guild World Platform. Global partners select the business, social, and health domains in order to harness the power of business to foster sustainable health and wealth for all. The world is 6.4 billion. 5% of the world is in North America. I didn't think we were just doing 5%, that's what I was saying, right? And by the way, that 95% of the land. So what will happen to the 5% of the land stay in? So I think to avoid the fraud, this has to be global.
I think most of us were there, and I hope you could not that in mind as well. I think the challenge is trying to find some precise things. I think this idea of obviously working with some of the global processes, that are already there around trade and other developments is something we can say. But I think our special niche is some of the spatial dimensions that are special to the city. The housing, the design, the food production, the water and the infrastructure. I think, if I had to sort of say it in a simple way, I think there's been a lot of suggestion that the answer to these really big challenges in the city is the lives of the people themselves being seen as a resource, being able to be trained to tackle some of these challenges. Maybe one of the roles of the West is to bring some of the know-how. Maybe that's a challenge that Ron and others are putting to all of us as professionals, that we should be thinking about, what evidence is there that we can actually tackle some of these issues in the right way, so that people are building with the best affordable homes, building transport connections that are going to, incentivize the kind of the good behaviors that we know. But I guess the empowering part is the part that runs right across all these sectors. Social policy person. I've been in a lot of poor communities. It's the days where these people need to look after themselves. They're not deferent to the West, they're not deferent to the foreigners. They want this is their space and they need to be empowered to build it themselves or create it the way they see fit. So I think that whatever sector, there is some know-how, some maybe capacity building that could generate the resources with very little external money that they can use.
Just to say people
okay. I'm going to sort of, let's take a vote of knowing that we will not be deprived of the opportunity to comment on these things again. And tonight when we both kind of between us construct the best, sectoral argument, I think, that builds on the common ground around the areas of the space, the areas that we've said. And there's going to be a chance for people to then pick up these themes through the 2 days that have been kind of thematically organized just to try and integrate across the centers. So we
organized thematic is a much better concept than one of the specific business opportunities.
Okay.
Thematically.
I mean, I think, for instance, the notion of building affordable housing with intelligent design is a business opportunity. It's not a concrete, specific thing, but it is a thematic conceptual idea where the goals that we're talking about in terms of livable cities, there is an opportunity for clients.
As well as residents themselves.
Well, absolutely, yes. But in terms of specifically what this could do, I think also this notion of, you know, when you have a livable city and you have common walkways, you have walkways and livable center city, and then this benefits business. This is more a question of sort of the other way around, of what can social intervention do to help private business rather than private business helping what you're doing. But it's a partnership, and private business has to see that this is going to help them in the long run. So again, I think this is an area of interaction between the two sectors.
We just have to be careful not to recommend only opportunity. We're not here to consult for the private sector. I'm not saying that you're doing that, but we have to be careful not to be consultants for the private sector and offer them good opportunities for business. We have to have them understand exactly what you're saying, that in the long term, a sustainable and healthy and equitable society is important for them, and have to do their homework. They have to be ethical, they have to be act responsibly, and so on.
Well, yes, I mean, obviously, they need significant degree of education to understand what they are going to lose if you have great equity. I mean, I sort of personally believe that the way we have it structured now, too much laissez-faire with industry is at odds with creating social equity. And they have to see that that isn't necessary.
I think we've kind of covered it out as well as we can at this point, Peter, just to let people make sure that people have a chance to have a break and get before we get reconvened in a very short time. So I'm going
to just want to say something important. I think we all are thanks to Avi for one of those.
I would like once again. In this concluding word, and you can see that the nature of the discussion shows how complex systems are, how you can look at them ground, up, helicopter, Cessna, or any other altitude. So they are very, but I was really intrigued and engaged by the beautiful ideas that, an idea that exchanged here today. And I would like to thank the organizers for making this opportunity to sit in a room in Montreal with people who think so wide and large and deep, and to enjoy your talk. Thank you very much for the concluding session with me. As you know, just on a administrative note, this is a prelude. You know, in other words, in the next 2 days, there will be even more engaging discussion, and you can hear today in the opening session of the think tank, wonderful presentation of people that were invited to open our mind and confuse us even more. So we will convene at 6 o'clock for a dinner, okay? This will be up. And once again, I sincerely appreciate those who came from far and near and contributed to the discussion. And I was told to the presenters to go somewhere outside, and you will even prepare a small gift for you. Okay, so something is waiting for you outside. And thank you once again for a wonderful day. Thank you.